Good morning, everybody. I'm Michael Swati, the director of the Center for Study of Working Class Life. I'd like to welcome you all here to the opening day. We did some work yesterday, and this is the first full day of the Hot Class Wars 2010 conference. Let me just give you a few little logistical details and information. The program is entirely in this building. The plenary session this morning is obviously here. Everything else is on the third floor, and there's a series of rooms that are all along one hallway. And to get to that third floor, you got to go out the lobby where you registered, to the other end of the lobby, turn right, and then on the right you'll see a staircase and also an elevator that goes up to the third floor. And that will take you directly to the hallway where all these sessions are happening. The full program is in your registration package. You can see day by day, hour by hour, where everything is. And I also call your attention to the addendum because there were a number of last minute changes. So, one important announcement for anybody here who has received some financial aid for the conference, I'm happy to say that we were able to raise money from the university here and from outside sources to support international travelers, graduate students, people of color, workers who are not part of the academic community, and others who did not have access to funds, so that we were able to support the 25 people coming here, 30 people. So that was a very nice thing that I think we should be grateful to the university. But, of course, there's paperwork involved. So, in particular, if you have received this financial aid, what you need to do is fill out some paperwork. You need to see Dan Wolman, who is the chief. Is Dan Wolman, or is he working on this? Stand up. Dan Wolman, you've all had contact with Dan. He's done a terrific job. And we're going to be sorry to lose the financial crisis in the university. Means that the Center for Study of Working Class Life will not have a graduate assistant starting at the end of this month. So we're very grateful that Dan has been able to do this work for a couple of years. And some of you remember Sam Butler before that, but now we're sort of back on our heels a bit. But if you are an international person, that is a person who comes to the United States with a passport from another country, and we are giving you money, you have to see Dan, because we need to have photocopies of the front of your passport and your I-94 form to show that you're here as illegally, so that we can issue, this is the state of New York now, this is not just something that's coming out of a box somewhere. So we really have to get the paperwork right. So at 12:15, after the sessions, the morning sessions, at the registration table, you've got to see Dan, who's going to take all those people to a photocopy machine so we can get that piece of the paperwork together. So, a couple other little announcements. Up on that third floor, in that row of classrooms, there's SAC 309, which is a bookstore. Our local bookstore, which is the Barnes & Noble, has set up there the titles of everybody who's presenting, plus some other titles which we thought you'd be interested in. And you can get those at a 20% discount and all kinds of other opportunities up on that third floor in SAC 309. And that'll be available all day today after 10:30 and then tomorrow until 4. So I do encourage you to stop in the midst of all the back and forth up there. Also, the Center for Study of Working Class Life in the gallery right next to this room on this floor has a little shop that we've set up. And in there we have some posters, some Ralph Facinella posters that were donated to us. We have some very nice posters from Milton Rogova that are signed and dated. And we also have DVDs, pamphlets, and other stuff that we've produced through our center. And you're welcome to go in there. And it's also a 20% discount. The posters are really great. We have mailing tubes so we can send it to you. And all the modern conveniences. These pastries, when we're done here, go up to the third floor. There's going to be another setup up there with coffee and tea, refreshment, but no pastries. Take the pastries. Do not let them stay here because they will just be trashed. So let's save the pastries by eating them. So we're going to open our program today with some tunes from a couple of just fabulous people we're so happy to have here. Ann Feeney and Elise Bryant are going to do the dog right now.
Under my feet. That Bruce?
Yeah, here.
Most of you know that Smithtown, Smithfield Foods had a major organizing campaign since the early 1990s. We could organize down an entire hill in North America. And the commercial workers, 2006, I think, hired Gene Grusin to run that campaign. And that was a successful campaign that resulted in the organization and the recognition of United Food and Commercial Workers as a collective bargain for those almost 6,000 workers there. Gene, in his experience running that campaign, when it was over, wrote it up a little bit. So I want to ask you to come up and tell us a little bit about that campaign.
Hi, good to be here. And this was a very exciting campaign to be a part of because this was the biggest pork and meat plant probably in the world, 5,000 people. And we've been trying, UOCW has been trying since 92 when it opened. And it was incredibly inspiring what the workers did. So I wrote something about it, made a little booklet about it, and I'm going to present that. This is a slightly abbreviated version, but it tells a story. There was a plant where they said you can't, so don't rave and rant, no matter how you feel, it's no big deal, because we're Smithfield, and we own Tar Heel. Since 92, when the plant was new, CEO Luder and crew said, the hell with you. UFCW 2, pigs are our deal, from the squeal to the meal. When the plant was complete, 1 million square feet, the biggest on earth, unimaginable girth, a daily drill of a 32,000 hot kill, lines racing, workers facing ungodly pacing, one motion every few seconds designed for body wrecking. You could be removed for missing one move in this relentless groove, cause with no tail and no snout, you really don't count. The plant is filled with gruesome squeals of dying pigs becoming a meal, with workers doing the whole deal. Why, there's rib and loin pullers, gutters and splitters, neck droppers, head droppers, neck breakers, pituitary pullers, tattooers, gas chambers, wizard knives, split saws, knee hair shavers, butt lines, loin lines, the final rail, the fatometer, the wet kill, the dry kill, 8 million hogs a year, more than workers' bodies can bear. Workers tramp by 300-pound hogs, fingers caught in machine cogs. Wrists destroyed so they can't lift baby boys, legs in pain from the standing strain, shoulders separated, backs wrecked, keeping pace in check, flirting daily with disaster to meet the harsh terms of an unforgiving master. So the workers organized, wanting to unionize to save their lives, hoping to survive the work-induced physical abuse, the lack of respect from a company unchecked, supervisors shouting, humiliating, never conciliating, no humanity, no dignity, just the sanctity of productivity. In 94, UFCW went on an organizing spree, hoping to hold a vote that was fair and free. In came the government's NLRB, but the workers were defeated when the company cheated, and the NLRB conceded another election was needed. For when the 97 election neared, as the workers had feared, Smithfield cheated and lied. Though the union tried, the company threatened and fired, harassed and spied. And when the final vote came, the company put on their full-court game. Sheriffs appeared in riot gear, standing there as workers arrived at work, while the company smirked as the vote count that ill-fated night. The company turned out the lights, started fistfights with appalling vigor, shouted, "Get the niggers!" As the violence crested, they had the workers arrested. With workers' hopes and tears, the union shifted gears. Totally outraged, they got the labor board engaged. Charges were piled, up the legal work piled. 9 years went by, with teams of lawyers from an unrelenting employer using every trick so the charges wouldn't stick. In 2006, the union said, "Hey, let's go. Tell the workers stories of woe in Boston, New York, and Chicago, clear across the nation, to Smithfield's consternation. Whenever Smithfield products were sold, workers' stories were being told. Smithfield pork is packaged with abuse. And Smithfield had no good excuse." People rallied nationwide, demanding justice by the workers' side. Churches, unions, group for civil rights, students and consumers joined the fight. They marched, picketed, emailed, phoned, passed resolutions, descended on supermarkets, refused to yield, and demanded justice at Smithfield. In August of 2007, the campaign began to leaven. 1,000 marched in Williamsburg, demanding that the workers be heard by Smithfield's board that was comfortably sequestered, plotting ample returns for their wealthy investors. But serious trouble burst the meeting's quiet bubble. Workers and ministers demanded admission, presenting thousands of workers' petitions, while CEO Luder leered and sneered. The crowds outside chanted and cheered, and the company decided to shift gears. By October 07, a new die was cast. Smithfield, tired of coming in last, filed a massive RICO suit, backed by lawyers with lots of loot, a move that seemed extreme and arcane, but Smithfield hoped to halt the campaign with charges wildly disproportionate, claiming the union was extortionate and feeling quite fortunate with a company-friendly judge. But the USCW didn't budge. While the wheels of injustice continued to turn and the public campaign continued to churn, the workers in the plant continued to learn to wage their fights for their union rights. In May of 06, Latinos closed the plant, marching with workers from across the land, standing and demanding, without profanity, simple fairness and humanity. Then in October 06, Smithfield went to workers one better. They issued 1,000 Social Security no-match letters. But immigrant workers said, "No, you can't. We put in too many years in this plant. Don't treat us this way. We're walking out." After 2 days, the company caved, the letters were waived, and the workers returned with a victory well earned. By January of 07, the no-match letters were back. ICE raided the plant in a daylight attack. Latino workers were forced to flee to the right wing's glee as the anti-immigrant wave rose from sea to sea. When the Latino workers were pushed out the door, the company professed deep love for these hard-working producers. But being equal opportunity abusers, they proved fully adroit at finding more blacks to exploit. Throughout the years, the leaders grew in numbers and in boldness too. Workers strategized more and more at the nearby Mexican store. Leaders created the plan for liberating territory in the plant, defying the notion that they can't, holding large lunchtime meetings in break rooms and hallways, and always wearing their Justice at Smithfield t-shirt and talking dirt about company abuse and vowing to refuse to be intimidated. Handing out Hogs Gone Wild, the workers' newsletter brainchild, chanting and ranting about injustice and making it clear there was nothing to fear. Union time was here. After the rain comes the sun. The workers prepare for the big one. Si se puede. As the RICO court was to open its doors, the company decided not to explore with a federal jury its gory story. Maybe afraid that if their case wasn't made and it didn't work, they would look like jerks if the jury found they were the clowns of infamous renown, a company unwelcome in Washington town with Obama around. Smithfield dropped the case. Some think they ducked. An election deal was struck, letting the UFCW in a plant with a monitor who could say that the company can't lie and cheat, fire and beat, and create the 97 heat. The deal tied their hands, their legal strategy in shambles. Smithfield took the gamble. On the union side was the Obama tie. His North Carolina win meant the change was in. And that drove the theme as the workers proclaimed, we can change the White House. We can change the office. Daily, at 4 a.m., there was 30 of them with leaflets that say, change we can believe in. Go for hope, not fear. Union time is here. Si, se, puede. Meanwhile, Smithfield played on ignorance and fear, saying, hey, Chef Jeff, Herschel Walker are here, passing out thousands of coat-nose shirts that did nothing to mend the workers' hurts, spreading rumors of plant closings, wages plundered, Latinos threatened, asking for another chance, to which the workers replied with union chants, queremos unión. When the word came, the final score of the game. Workers win. Smithfield shame. Workers cried. Danced in the cafeteria. There was near hysteria. Organizers shouting. Company pouting. For 16 years, the company had lied and tried to claim that they spoke in the workers' name, that workers wanted things to say the same. But hope springs eternal in the human soul. The workers reached their hard-fought goal. And as the next day's dawn was near, down in Tar Heel, you could hear the workers' chant become a cheer. We changed the hot. We changed the hot, guys. We changed the hot.
Embody the aspirations of the people. Now, populism is a response to unsettling shifts in people's perception of their status, fear of the future, and nostalgia for the way things were, or at least the way people think they were. It's based on the perception that the system is unfair, that elites abuse the people, and there's right-wing populism, and there's left-wing populism. Right-wing populism is different. It draws a circle around an us and a them in a way that divides the working people. That's what right-wing populism is about. That's its purpose. That's what it does. Left-wing populism contains the elements of an us against them, but the us is a solidarity us of a united working people against a class of abusive capitalist owners and exploiters. Today's extreme right populism grows in a climate of the failure of the contemporary economic system, is driven by a campaign to misdirect blame for the loss of status, of livelihood, why we have fears of the future. It starts from an implicit values orientation of racial, patriarchal, and national privilege. Its enemy is a liberal elite, which is seen in league with an undeserving poor and foreign elements, and demands leaders who will stand up for the real America. It is heir to the right-wing populism of the Great Depression era, when the labor upsurge of the New Deal produced a powerful counter to free market orthodoxy. It's the heir of the 1950s right-wing, which found domestic betrayal in the face of the rise of the Soviet Union as a superpower challenging America's hegemonic status. It's the heir from the 1960s of the enemies of the civil rights movement, of feminism, and the anti-war movements. And today, it fears demographic trends which signal the end of a presumption of a white Christian American. It measures much of what has gone wrong by the election of the country's first black president. This extreme and often violent right has taken many forms, the Ku Klux Klan, abortion, clinic bombing, and today the Tea Party. I want to begin by saying something about the original Populist Party of the 1890s in this country. The Populist Party's 1892 Omaha platform declared that, quote, the fruits of the toil of millions are boldly stolen to build the fortunes for a few. Unprecedented in the history of mankind, and the possessors of these in turn, despise the republic and endanger liberty. We declare that this republic can only endure as a free government while building upon the love of the whole people for each other and for the nation. Now, we recognize in this 1892 rhetoric the claim today of the right-wing populists of the Tea Party, except that they do not speak of the love of the whole people for each other. This is a secessionist movement premised on dividing America. It does not offer a positive vision of an America in which all are respected and the country supports opportunity for people to live and work in dignity and share the fruits of the collective product of labor. Now, the original populists had a number of positive ideas. One way you identify the right-wing populists is they have no positive ideas. The original populists had ideas like the 8-hour day, the progressive income tax, the secret ballot, women's suffrage, and the popular election of senators. They advocated as well for public ownership of railroads, steamship lines, and telephone and telegraph companies. In a period of deflation, as the 1890s were, in which farmers' debts were heavier burdens, it supported the free and unlimited coinage of silver. This sounds arcane to you, but it was a way to break the grip of Wall Street, because Wall Street likes deflation. The bankers don't like inflation. They don't like full employment. They don't like farmers able to earn a living. The railroads at the time raised the price of getting the crops to market whenever the price rose. They lowered it when the prices fell because they didn't want the farmers to make money, but they didn't want them to die because they got their exploitative pound of flesh from the work of the farmers. And so they geared it so that very little was left to working people after they had had theirs. One aspect of the 19th century populist movement, thinking that we would do well to revisit at a time when the bankers have taken us to the cleaners and we are learning more of what Goldman Sachs and Citigroup have done, is to understand the social meaning of money, which the populace understood and we do not. Lawrence Goodwin, who has done so much to help us understand what is called the financial question, as it was called by the populace, writes of the defining elections of the 1890s, the importance of the issue can scarcely be exaggerated. How money was created and on what basis it circulated defined in critical ways the relationship of farmers, urban workers, and commercial participants in the emerging industrial state. The answers would go a long way toward determining who controlled the rules of credit and commerce, who shared in the fruits of increasing American production, and ultimately, how many Americans obtained that minimum income necessary to ensure that they lived lives of some dignity. It would be well to think about the social meaning of money today, as financial capital has created a crisis and is making us pay and will make us continue to pay until working class people understand these relationships. Agrarian populism in the Western states arose out of the declining relevance of the myth of individualism, something worth thinking about. Populism arose to challenge the myth of individualism and the rise of corporate power in America. As John D. Higgs tells the story of the transition from, quote, the ideal of individualism of the frontier to the ideal of social control through regulation by law, a formulation he draws from Frederick Jackson Turner, he of the famous frontier thesis, Higgs describes how farmers came to fix the blame for their situation on the manufacturers, the railroads, the moneylenders, the middlemen, the plutocrats all, what they were taking from labor, what they were taking from honest Americans, honest working people. Higgs writes of their philosophy, it boils down to two propositions. One, that the government must restrain the selfish tendencies of those who profit at the expense of the poor and needy, and the working people were the poor and the needy in the 1890s. There was not that distinction between so-called honest workers and poor people because the populace understood the working class included all who toil and are oppressed by capital. The radical vision of populism that informs this kind of thinking is the progressive populism that must be recaptured. Now, I don't want to give too one-sided a sense of the populace. Richard Hofstadter has characterized the party as isolationist, xenophobic, anti-intellectual, anti-Semitic. And there is some truth in all of this. It was a diverse and complex movement. C. Van Woodward's classic treatment of the complex figure of Tom Watson. I remember at a stick meeting, somebody got up as white people were being asked to leave the organization and said, Tom Watson, and sat down. I don't know if this means much to you. Tom Watson was a founder of the Populist Party in Georgia, uniting farmers across class lines, and to a remarkable extent, overcoming the racial divide. He supported the rights of black men, to vote. Yet later in his life, he became anti-Semitic, anti-Catholic, and a racist Ku Klux Klanner. In Van Woodward's telling, it was the defeat at the hands of the irresistible forces of industrial capitalism that broke the movement and changed this man, leading to his reactionary turn, and suggesting to us that in the moment of weakness, in the moment of the defeat of progressive movements, the turn towards the Ku Klux Klan, to anti-Semitism, anti-Catholic, anti-immigrant, is very real. And it comes out of the sense of being defeated and circling the wagons around identities that divide the class. The psychology of frustration, being on the wrong side of history, is powerful. In defeat lurks this backwardness, this fear of the future, which is a powerful divider. It is a big part of right-wing populism. We see it in George Wallace's 1968 presidential campaign, in which he won over 13% of the popular vote. We see it in the Tea Party today. We see it in the McCarthyism of the 1950s, the John Birch Society. We see it when Americans have had things taken away from them and their kind, and are determined to try to repossess it, but do not understand class. And this prevents the only unity that can turn things around. Now, whether it's Senator Joe McCarthy asserting that communists had taken over the government and that Dwight David Eisenhower was in fact a communist, or Rush Limbaugh calling Barack Obama far worse than that, polls show these elements, the right-wing populace, tend to be racist, and as judged by their view of blacks, that blacks get more they're entitled to, and the claims by Glenn Beck of Fox News calling President Obama a racist, and claiming he, quote, has exposed himself as a guy over and again who has a, quote, deep-seated hatred for white people and white culture. This is the kind of reactionary stuff that is now infecting our country. Congressional Republicans, just like the Tea Party, do not acknowledge anyone to the right of them have the right to govern the country. Hence the cries of traitors and socialists and all the rest of it. Dick Armey, who was the Republican leader in the House and is now the paymaster for the Tea Party, spoke of President Clinton as your president, not acknowledging the legitimacy of Clinton's victory. Now, whatever you may think of Clinton today, especially his role in Arkansas in the primary, which will be discussed in the session later today, I'm happy to say, or tomorrow, I think. This idea that the Harris poll reports a majority of the Republicans believe President Obama is a Muslim and a socialist, majority of Republicans. And while only a quarter of Republicans think he's the Antichrist, a majority of Republicans do believe President Obama, quote, wants to turn over the sovereignty of the United States to a one world government. Now, we speak of the Tea Party, we speak of the extreme right. I'm speaking here of the Republican Party and a larger right-wing presence in America that the Tea Party is the tip of the spear of. And I think in our division, Bill is going to focus on them. My emphasis is on the continuity from these extreme right, racist, fascist ideas to the beliefs of one of our two major parties, and on to the conservative Democrats, and then to the corporate Democrats. Because in our duopoly, in which corporate Democrats represent one wing of the class, and Republicans represent a different alliance and faction, in America, I don't want you to forget any part of that, and I will talk more about the Democrats a little bit later. This is not to say that in 10 races out of 10, the Democratic candidate is not by far the lesser of two evils and is often the better person and someone we can enthusiastically support. But the corporate Democrats, the blue dog Democrats, are a very different thing, and we have to understand the contradictions and how capital works in both parties and not just in one. Now, I want to say a few words about racism, and doing this, I want to draw on Tim Weiss. Tim Weiss invites us to imagine the following. So, I know this would be a big stretch, but try with Tim Weiss to imagine the following. Imagine that hundreds of black protesters were to descend upon Washington, D.C. in Northern Virginia, just a few miles from the Capitol and White House, armed with AK-47s, assorted handguns and ammunition. And imagine that some of these protesters, black protesters, mind you, spoke of the need for political revolution and possibly even armed conflict in the event the law they didn't like were enforced by the government. Would these protesters, these black protesters with guns, be seen as brave defenders of the Second Amendment? First question. Imagine the white members of Congress, while walking to work, were surrounded by thousands of angry black people, one of whom proceeded to spit on one of those congressmen for not voting the way the black demonstrators desired. Would the protesters be seen as merely patriotic Americans voicing their opinions, or as an angry, potentially violent, and even insurrectionary mob. After all, this is what the Tea Party did. Imagine that a rap artist were to say, in reference to a white president, quote, he's a piece of shit, and I told him to suck on my machine gun, unquote. Because that's what rocker Ted Nugent said recently about President Obama. Imagine a black radio host gleefully predicting a revolution by people of color if the government continues to be dominated by the rich white men who have been, quote, destroying the country. Or if said radio personality would call Christians or Jews non-humans. Or say that when it came to conservatives, the best solution would be to hang them high. And what would happen to any congressional representative who praised that commentator for speaking common sense and likened his hate talk to American values? But after all, those are among the things said by radio host and best-selling author Michael Savage, predicting white revolution in the face of multiculturalism, or said by Savage about Muslims and liberals, respectively. And it was Congressman Culbertson from Texas who praised Savage in that way, despite his hateful rhetoric. This is America today, and when you think of the reversal, if black Americans did any of these things, what the consequences would be, you get a sense of the depth and the pervasiveness of the unconscious racism, as well, of course, as its manifestations. The iconography of the radical right suggests a good bit of states' rights philosophy of the Confederacy. There's a Revolutionary War, these guys walking around in their uniforms and all that, but it's the cause of the South, the Civil War, of the sovereign citizen resisting a far-off oppressive government that allows this reactionary stew, which includes birthers who believe Obama was born in Kenya and his Hawaiian birth certificate is fake. So we have birthers, we have tenthers. Tenthers are those who rely on the 10th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. You remember, the power has not been delegated to the United States by the Constitution, not prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Which is to say, anything Washington does that we don't like, fuck them, we're not going to obey the laws. That's not how we do things here in big country or wherever they happen to be. So we have the secessionist movement based on an awareness that the America that is being created is a multicultural, multinational society in which over the next decade, the white so-called majority becomes a minority. It's already a minority in many states. And between progressive white people, working class people, and progressive minority groups, the possibility of a very different country is possible. And if we work hard and if we make our alliances strong, we will have that kind of country that goes beyond this horrible moment that we're in now. In the states where the things are worse, like Arizona, which has passed, Arizona is the state that has the largest gap between the demographics of the older population, the over 50, over 65, and the under 35, under 25. That is, the older folks are white, the younger folks are non-white. And one reason you're seeing this in Arizona so intensely is the nature of Arizona is changing. The composition of the workforce, of the voting population is changing, and the kind of crap we're getting now as people get their citizenship, as their children born in America vote, you're going to see a different Arizona. And if you look at the difference between, say, we have 435 congressional districts, look at the 1992 demographics and election patterns, and I don't want to give you a lot of numbers here, but if you compare that to today, districts in which minorities make up at least 40% of the population have increased from 80 to 135 in congressional districts. So the resistance we're seeing now is a resistance to the changing nature of America. Now, globally, we're seeing the same thing. In places like Hungary, it's the Roma or the Gypsies who are the foreign element that must be expelled. In Slovakia, it's actually the Hungarians they're trying to get rid of, right? Every country, we're seeing the same kind of hatred of immigrants, hatred of others, a going back to the tribal thinking of the Tea Party kind of white thinking. The world is changing, and the intensity of this struggle is changing. I'm told I have 5 minutes, and I'm here 15 pages of the total presentation. Let me say a few words about the Tea Party. First, let me say, if you go to SourceWatch or Media Matters or ThinkProgressive.org or Talking Points Memo, other known websites, you see who pays for the Tea Party. It is the right-wing people who fund the right-wing think tanks. It's David Koch of Koch Industries, the largest privately held energy company in the country, who funds Freedom Works and Americans for Prosperity. These are the groups who fund the Tea Party. The Tea Party is not this, you know, mushroom thing. It is the creation of Fox News and some of the wealthiest right-wing fanatics in America. The Tea Party Express is another arm. They spent $350,000 to help elect Scott Brown in Massachusetts. The Tea Party Express was organized by a Republican consulting firm, and we know because the Political Action Committee sent 2/3 of the money that they raised from other people back to the Republican consultants who set it up so they could recycle it to set up something else. This is the Tea Party. This is how the conservatives are working. It is a, you'll see a lot of different polls. I don't have time for all this, but look at the source of the poll. That the right-wing think tanks are doing their own polls, which show the Tea Party is just your average American, average guy, concerned citizen, all that. The Wall Street Journal webpage and Petro page full of shit. Actually, it is overwhelmingly Republican. It is 99% white. It is what you would expect of a group that is basically the most angry part of the Tea Party. Now, I want to say a few things about the next cultural war that I've got to end. The next cultural war is not about religion, abortion, guns, and all the rest of it. It is about the functions of government. And the libertarian philosophy, the anti-state philosophy, the anti-tax philosophy, this is the battlefield we are now on. Because the cultural stuff does not work. They've maxed out on that. They are now going for free enterprise, the destruction of solidarity, the destruction of social security, all the things they wanted to do, but where the extreme wealthy section that has led the right is now coming into its own and not working through the racists and the Christian fundamentalists. And this is the real reason the Tea Party is that point of the spear of the movement. The Tea Party advocates cutting taxes. I think people here know that the wealthy in our country in 1960, the top 0.1% paid 60% of their income in taxes. In 2004, thanks to tax cuts, they paid only 1/3 of their income in taxes. That they have received 80% of the increase of income in the last decade. The wealthy have made out both before tax and after tax. Most people do not pay income tax. Most people do not pay federal income tax. They do pay payroll taxes through the nose. So you never hear, let's cut the payroll tax to create jobs. No, it's always let's cut the income tax so that the rich people can pay even less. The tax nature and this new way of phrasing individualism versus solidarity is the focal point of what we must be concerned with the Tea Party. My time is up. Michael says some of the talks, if people want, will go up on the website. I'm looking at all the things that I can tell you, but in the question and discussion period, there's lots to talk about, and Bill will cover, I'm sure, a lot of it much better than I would. Thank you very much. This is where. Okay, good. Good morning. So I want to thank
Mike, for inviting me to speak with you this morning. And before I get into my remarks, I just want to say how proud of Gene Ruskin I am. How angry I am with the United Food and Commercial Workers that they would lose, and I'm putting that diplomatically, such a wonderful strategist, and particularly when the union movement is getting its asses kicked, when we need people like Gene. But it just always reminds me of this metaphor, the drowning man and the goal. His ship goes down and a rowboat comes over to him to offer him help out of the water. And he has his goal, the sack of gold. And they say, you have to drop the sack of gold in order to get into the rowboat. And he says, no, I can't do that. If I drop the gold, then I have nothing. And so he said, you have to drop the gold and get into the rowboat. So he didn't drop the gold and he drowned. And I think that speaks volumes to what's going on in our movement right now. I also want to thank Bill Tapp for his remarks. And I really do look forward to being published because he sent it in advance. I was very excited by them. My remarks are going to take off from Bill's. I'm going to eventually talk some about labor and the left and the impact of right-wing populism. In referring to right-wing populism in a U.S. context, I often like to say metaphorically that it exists as a herpes in the system of racial capitalism that we have here in the U.S. By this I mean it's a social phenomenon that never quite disappears. It's in the system due to a whole set of historical reasons, which I'll touch on below. But short of a fundamental social transformation in the United States, it appears and disappears. It rises or diminishes in strength due in large part to the immune system and its relative strengths and weaknesses. Thus, to the extent to which the economy is doing well and the U.S. empire appears to be under less international stress, right-wing populism is largely held in check. When, however, there is a periodic economic crisis, and when there are additional stresses on the system, right-wing populism emerges and brings with it a proliferation of political illnesses. Though right-wing populism in its various incarnations exists throughout the global capitalist system, in each individual social formation, it takes on a particular character. While there are similarities between the right-wing populism of Le Pen's Front National in France, or the Northern Leagues in Italy, and the movement of Sarah Palin, or the one that she's trying to lead, they are equally distinct. To understand right-wing populism in the U.S., I encourage you to read the Verlet Lyons book, Right-Wing Populism in America. I think that this actually should be required reading for all progressive and left activists and scholars. What I want to do here is to highlight what I believe to be some of the key elements of U.S. right-wing populism and then go on to discuss the particular challenges that it offers the union movement and the left. Right-wing populism in the U.S. needs to be understood in the context of the U.S. as a racial settler state. Verlet and Lyons take us back to the founding of the U.S. and then to the person who can be identified as the godfather of right-wing populism in the U.S., President Andrew Jackson. I do not want to do a disservice to Verlet and Lyons, but I do want to summarize some key features of the U.S. system that make it particularly susceptible to a particular form of right-wing populism. The U.S. was founded as a settler state. Its origin in the 13 colonies was that of a project that envisioned the removal of the indigenous population and the creation of an entirely new social formation. We all know that, but we tend not to think of the totality of the implications. The U.S. War of Independence, to a great extent, was fought over the refusal of the British Crown to permit the expansion of the 13 colonies west of the Appalachians. In other words, expansion was built into the very fabric of the project that came to be known as the U.S. This expansion was to know no bounds, which helps one understand why for Thomas Jefferson and many of the so-called founding fathers, there was no inconsistency between the notion of a republic and that of an empire. Neither people nor treaties were to stand in the way of expansion. Settler states are armed. That is, the settlers are encouraged to bear arms and their loyalty is to the settler state and its objectives. The settler state is to serve the settler and to remove obstacles to the improvement of the life of the settler. Settler states are racial in their definition. They define the legitimate and the relevant populations of racial, a truism applicable to the U.S., Israel, Australia, or pre-liberation South Africa. Non-settlers are not supposed to reap the benefits of the settler state. The settlers are the people. And even when they have differences with the elite within a settler state, those differences, no matter how antagonistic, are framed as if they are on a different dimensional plane than are differences with those outside of the parameters of the settler state. By way of example, outside of the United States, I'll use from South Africa the Anglo-Boer Wars of the end of the 19th century, which was a fight between whites over who would lead the construction of a settler state, the Boers or the British. The Africans were irrelevant in this war in a philosophical sense. Another example that comes from the labor movement, which is actually quite phenomenal, was a strike in the 1920s by white workers where the slogan was "Workers of the world unite and fight for a white South Africa." Andrew Jackson positioned himself in his politics as serving the interests of the common man, by which he meant the common white settler man. He was speaking for them against the well-to-do within the U.S., but he was doing it in such a way as to guarantee that the common white settler had the freedom to gain land, and the state was to operate on their behalf, securing the land and financing where necessary, as well as providing protection. In effect, a covenant was to exist between the common white man and the settler state. U.S. right-wing populism has taken its cues from the oxymoronic Jacksonian democracy ever since. The state is to guarantee the advancement of the relevant population, that is, the settler population, as transformed into the white bloc. The oath of the settler population or the white bloc is to the settler state, and there is the expectation that the racial settler state will be the guarantor of fairness for them, with fairness a relative concept since the settler is always supposed to win over the non-settler. Right-wing populism draws much of its strength from a narrative which parallels that of the so-called American dream. The right-wing populists are just a bit less vague as to who is to benefit from the American dream and who is to be left aside. It is a compelling narrative, one focused on white people and one that explains how the decline of their living standard is not their fault, but it is also not an act of God. It is the result of a grand betrayal carried out by certain unsavory forces. Right-wing populism is not monolithic, however. There are isolationists, there are fascists, anti-Semites, Christian Zionists, empire builders, and even those who advocate what in Europe is called the Red-Brown Alliance against capitalism, that is, the alliance of the left and right-wing populists. What they tend to share in common is their search for scapegoats, as Bill was pointing out. Scapegoats behind the weakening of the empire and the decline of the living standard of the average white working person. They're also speaking to, for, and about white people, even when they occasionally make tactical alliances with other groups, such as every so often trying to figure out how some segment of the Latino population are white. They critique capitalism at times, but from the standpoint of the middle strata, attacking the excesses of capitalism that hurt the ability for the small business person, craft person, manager, etc., to compete and thrive. In that sense, they are not and never will be anti-capitalist, but they may be anti-corporate. They talk about the people versus the rich. They talk about the people versus the vampire state. But the people represents only a segment of who we would define to be the people. I should add a final point here. We should keep in mind that within this milieu of right-wing populism, there are some extremely well-armed forces that are prepared to carry out attacks against targets that they believe to be immediate or long-term threats. The militia movement is just one variant of this armed wing. The Posse Comitatus from the 1980s was another example. There are many of us on the left side of the aisle who would rather not dwell on this particular part of reality. Now, in terms of challenges for labor, although it may sound extreme, I'll argue to you that mainstream or traditional trade unionism is actually incapable of confronting and defeating right-wing populism. Traditional Gompers-inspired unionism either does not see the importance of fighting right-wing populism, or believes that a program of what I call economic inoculation will ensure that workers are less receptive to the irrationalism of right-wing populism. But both approaches fail. Right-wing populism offers a worldview which mainstream unionism does not. It actually looks at the total white person and addresses his or her anxieties. By contrast, mainstream unionism tends to look at the worker only within the context of their work environment. While leftist-inspired unionism has attempted to break outside of these parameters, this has not been the hegemonic approach. Ironically, even when confronted with the appeal of right-wing populism on its own members, mainstream unionism is largely paralyzed. All things considered, the union movement does represent a potential base for an anti-right-wing populist struggle. In order for this potential to surface, certain dramatic changes will take place, and it is at least even money as to whether that will happen. In order to explain what is necessary, I want to just reflect on briefly on an effort that was undertaken in the 1990s to construct a labor-based narrative to promote a progressive populist response to the crisis. It was known as Common Sense Economics. Briefly, what it was the AFL-CIO and affiliates put together a program to describe capitalism, to talk about class, and talk about who are our friends and who are our enemies, and use this to inspire workers to action around organizing and political action. The effort presented something that I think, within the U.S. context, was quite remarkable for all of its limitations. But what ended up ultimately happening was that once it was completed, it wasn't deployed in the way that was necessary. Once again, the leaders of organized labor felt that either education was truly unnecessary or that common sense economics was pushing the envelope too much. And they were more comfortable with the idea that education would be sending out emails or sending out flyers and telling the workers what to think, rather than constructing a narrative that was directly related to the reality of the worker and something that the workers could adopt and see as their own. It's very ironic because what common sense economics ultimately did was it laid the basis for understanding the crisis that we're currently going through, the collapse and the debt. Part of the difficulty for labor is its inability and unwillingness to challenge much of the myth of U.S. history. This is in part a legacy of Gompers-based unionism and anti-communism. For example, while it is absolutely true that the living standard of the U.S. rose from 1945 to 1975, those were also the years of U.S. global economic hegemony and political dominance over the non-Soviet world, years of wars and successive U.S. interventions in order to crush anti-imperialist efforts. Those were also the years where the benefits of the American dream were divided very unequally, at least racially, and certainly they were divided unequally globally. None of this is what the leaders of organized labor are comfortable addressing. Right-wing populism is able to look at that period and draw the conclusion that the 1950s were indeed the best years of our lives, of course, depending on how one defines our. Income inequality was relatively low, this is true, by today's standards, while racial inequality was extremely deep. The U.S. was at the top of its game, and foreign opponents were being crushed, or at least challenged, and organized labor during that same period was largely in cahoots. A few thoughts on the left. The left has overlapping challenges with organized labor with regard to right-wing populism. One has to do with the Obama presidency. For that section of the left of progressive movements that supported Obama, of which I was part of, we have to understand the political character of this administration. It is liberal, tending towards center-right. It's neither progressive nor left. It is very corporate, yet it is not Bush. It's rather more a variant on Clintonism. The antipathy of the right-wing populists for Obama and their racist offensive should not, however, lead progressives and leftists to believe that silence is golden, or that any kind of criticism of Obama gives aid and comfort to the enemy. In fact, we should adopt exactly the opposite. It's not enough to criticize the administration when it fails to advance pro-people projects, We must advance a different narrative and an alternative program. To this, we must add a willingness to engage in active, vocal, and disruptive protest. While left and progressive forces must be looking for immediate answers, without which we will not be taken seriously, we on the left, particularly, must also advance an anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist vision and program. What do I mean by this? The convergence of three crises, which I can't go into because I don't have time. I have 5 minutes. The economic crisis, the environmental crisis, and the crisis of the legitimacy of the state, which Bill began to touch on, means that radical measures must be undertaken. The environmental crisis, for instance, could conceivably result in humanity living underground or in domed cities if things keep going the way that they have. Such a scenario would probably mean an authoritarian reorganization of society. I found myself thinking recently about a comment that I believe that Mike Davis speculated on when he was talking about environmental denial, at least being in part based on a right-wing assumption as to where the resources will be, who will have them, in order to survive an environmental apocalypse. The left must challenge right-wing populism on many levels. It must challenge irrationalism such as the birthers or climate denial. It must be seen as the ones targeting and leading the charge against corporate America, and it must be the ones who promote genuine internationalism, both at the reform level of democratic with a small d foreign policy, and at a more radical level, global justice solidarity. The base for right-wing populism sees and feels the world changing in ways that are very uncomfortable. The prerogative that comes with U.S. hegemony no longer seems to be there. Race is being turned upside down, not in the form of reverse racism, but in the form of something that can be called global elite multiculturalism. We now have the Oprahs, the Tiger Woods, the public high-profile interracial relationships like Kim Kardashian and NFL player Reggie Bush, although they're not together right now, which only a few years ago would simply not have been permitted. It might have been literally forbidden. We have Japanese investors, but now we have Chinese. We have people from Dubai. And at home, in contrast, we have dying cities like Flint, Michigan, where the collapse of the housing market in such diverse areas as California and South Florida. We have people losing homes, losing their futures, unlike anything that would ever have been expected. It feels to much of white America that it does not pay to be either white or American anymore. In this situation, a redefined class politics and true global justice solidarity needs to become the framework and practice to create a new human identity and a basis for optimism regarding the future. In other words, it becomes a task of the 21st century left to create a framework that grows from the experiences of the progressive social movements but transcends them. This is a task at the level of both theory and practice. That is a task not of enlightened individuals, but of an organized left that recognizes that driving the herpes from the system of U.S. capitalism actually involves social transformation. This will not happen through pure thoughts, magical thinking, or spontaneous popular revulsion to barbarism that is coming towards us. To borrow from the words of A. Philip Randolph, at the banquet table of nature, there are no reserved seats. You get what you can take and you keep what you can hold. If you can't take anything, you won't get anything. And if you can't hold anything, you won't keep anything. And you can't take anything without organization. Organization and the forms of organization necessary for this period go beyond what I can discuss today. I will, however, leave this matter for your consideration to borrow from Rod Serling, since it is clear that lacking organization, we lack a method to build both a new narrative as well as a countervailing force to completely crush the right. Thank you.
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much. I have a roving mic that we didn't have last night, and if I can figure out to push that button and hold it so the green light comes on. We have about 10 minutes left, and what I want to do is just raise your hand, or just come on up here, and
So if you've got a question, but don't forget we only have a little less than 10 minutes.
Yeah, real simple, Tim Shears from Brooklyn.
Bill, I appreciate the mark for the lesson. If they have been published online,
the movement will remain
public.
Okay, back to Bill.
I'm sorry, I had difficulty hearing the last speaker as did Fletcher. Hold the microphone maybe closer to your...
Point is the connection between the margin and the mainstream, either from understanding the development of capitalism and racism, or the struggle against capitalism and racism. That connection was obfuscated in the right wing rhetoric, and Marxism has not been able to integrate it either.
So we have three items there for your consideration. Do whatever you want for a couple minutes each, and then we have to call it. But let me just say that Bills will be here for the day, and we'll want to continue the conversation with either. We'll have an opportunity to do that.
I'm going to respond to the middle question because for me it's the most important, the issue of privatization, that what we're watching in taking away people's pensions, their retirement, their education, the privatizing of absolutely everything, the reduction to individualistic freedom, as if you can choose your own health plan, but you don't have money to pay for any of them, as you choose your own education, but there are no more scholarships, no more ways for working class kids to go to school. This, to me, is what the working class movement has to focus on. It is the difference between an individualism that destroys the hopes of the future of working people and the principle of solidarity and of equality and of the collective labor of all the working class people going fed back to working class people to meet working class needs. It is this that the Tea Party and the extreme right is always strongest against. It is a movement that is heavily led by small and medium-sized business that doesn't want to pay any taxes, that doesn't want the welfare state. You see, in the effort to privatize Social Security is not in any danger. For the next 40 years, even by the more conservative estimates, it's not in danger for 40 years. Healthcare is. The cost of healthcare is rising. The only thing that's going to stop that is single payer. They refuse to deal with the real issues. They're going after Social Security because it is the most important achievement of the New Deal and the progressive movement, and yet it is not. We didn't cause the crisis. Social Security didn't cause it. It's perfectly sound, despite all the stuff. So the effort to privatize government, to privatize everything, is, to me, the cutting-edge issue, and we have to find ways. The first questioner asked about talking to the people who support these right-wing ideologies. They support Social Security. They happen to think the government's trying to destroy it, and they're right, but it is a government program. It is the kind of thing we should expect from our government. So that in thinking about how to address the challenge of the right, explaining in very straightforward terms what social solidarity is about and why the corporate rich are trying to privatize everything and what the consequences of that is, seems to me the central point for us to focus on.
Just very quickly, I'll have to speak with the final question outside. I didn't get the question, I'm sorry. The right is extremely contradictory about this issue of private and individual. Because on the one hand, there's a segment of the right that absolutely pushes the issue of privatization. But you can see within the right to search for a collective. I mean, things like the militia movement and others, they are trying to create a different sense of community. They are redefining, Bill was starting to touch on this in his remarks, they're trying to redefine a community and the other. And so they send out these very contradictory messages about what should be private, what should be not, what should be in the hands of some sort of collective. And so that is a place that we can get. We can see, for example, in the collapse in 2008, what a lot of the right doesn't want to admit right now is that millions and millions of people were yelling together, the government has to do something. Everything is collapsing. When things stabilize, then the right comes out and starts saying nothing. Now, in Louisiana, this oil disaster, Bobby Jindal, you know, a staunch advocate of opponent of big government, what's he doing? Virtually crying on CNN for more government intervention and assistance. So there's ways that we can take them apart. And so, you know, we should just keep that in mind because they're... See, the one thing I always like to say about the right is the right is never constrained by the truth. And so they will use any argument at any time in order to attack us and to attack the basic notion that there should be a society, as opposed to what Margaret Thatcher said, which is that there is no such thing as society, just individuals and families.
Well, thank you so much.